Welcome to our podcast series. We hope you enjoy and are blessed by the stories, wisdom, and inspiration of the Medical Mission Sisters. Thank you for listening.
I had never met a Medical Mission Sister, but had a Catholic education for grade school and high school. And at high school, we were always doing things to raise money. So one of the programs we had was to try to sell magazine subscriptions. And when I didn't reach my quota and I was kind of whining about it to my mother, she said, okay, I'll take a subscription. And she looked at the list and said, I'll help the good sisters. So the Medical Missionary magazine began to come into our house. And at first, I didn't pay so much attention, but then I started reading it, and it captured my heart. And I said, this is what I want to do. I want to be one of these women. And so I started correspondence with them. And after I graduated from high school, I applied officially and got accepted and took the night train to Philadelphia. And with my little gray suitcase packed with the things they told me I needed to bring, walked down the winding road at 8400 Pine Road. So that's how I got here.
Did you think about being a sister before you started reading the magazine?
Yes, I did. It's like I said, I grew up in a very religious household. A Polish heritage, and so we were always at church, or my brothers were always altar boys at church, and so it's like we lived in the shadow of the church, and it was just at that time, it was one of the things that was a real option for young people to do. And I just didn't want to be a school sister, you know. The thought of being a missionary sister, to be a doctor maybe and go to India, well, that really spoke to me and got me excited about wanting to become one.
So you came to Philadelphia, and you're not a doctor. Can you talk a little bit about what your first experiences were, or where you went to school, kind of how that evolved for you?
Well, because I came right out of high school, I needed college education, and I got sent to the College of Notre Dame. It's now the University of Notre Dame in California. It was an all-girls school. I wanted to go to a big university, but anyway, I got a tremendous education there because the classes were small and you got very close attention by the teachers. So I majored in biology, and from there I was to go to New York to study medicine. Well, and this was at a time when there were not a lot of women, you know, in the medical field, but I got accepted. And I went there, and in the first year, I knew someplace deep down inside of me, this was not for me. I wasn't going to make it here. Not academically, but, you know, in terms of who I was. So then I had to tell the school, which was a biggie, and tell Medical Mission Sisters. It left me with I felt when I made that decision, I felt like I jumped off a cliff and there was no bottom. Wow. Because I couldn't figure out who I was, what I was going to do, how I was going to continue to be a medical mission sister if I didn't have what I called a marketable skill. Yeah. So, you kind of flounder at times like this. You don't know what to do. I got a few different kinds of jobs. I worked for the Management Design Incorporated. They worked with group. And I had put my name in the pot to say, I'll go any place and do anything, you know, around the world. Well, this was a time of great change. So, you know, there was a lot of upset in the society, and I think when people looked at me, they go, what can she do? You know, she has no experience. Yeah, what do you do with a bachelor's in biology? And, you know, maybe she's just not too stable. So nobody actually, you know, wanted me to work for them. So when a group, and this was also a time in the society when a lot of sisters were coming back from overseas, because hospitals were being turned over, everything that happened with the changes of Vatican II and our own 1967 Constitution, there was a lot of chaos going on, a lot of chaos. And we did have sisters coming back and trying to find mission in North America. And if I look back at that time, there were a lot of different endeavors in many small groups in different places. And there was Catherine Volker, was a nurse who had spent 15 years in India. Pat Elin has spent 12 years in Venezuela. Catherine originally came from the South. She was born and raised in Atlanta. And she always, when she came back from India, she says, now's my time to go to Georgia, because Georgia also is mission territory. She remembers the time when there was a priest who would come and say mass on the back of his car, because, I mean, there weren't churches. Georgia was less than 1% Catholic at the time. So, aside from Atlanta, I mean, the rest of Georgia. So she said, we're going to try and go down and find out what we can do in Georgia. So Pat, Catherine, and I drove down. In Georgia, there are two dioceses, Atlanta, which covered the whole top part of the state, and Savannah, which was the whole bottom part of the state. And Georgia is a very big state. So we went to, because we wanted to go to South Georgia, that's where the poorest area was, and we went to meet with the bishop, saying, this is who we are, these are what we can bring, what do you suggest? At first he was, wanted to know if we were really legitimate, so he contacted Philadelphia to say, are these people really, really medical mission sisters? When he got his answer, he said yes. And I remember the day we were sitting in his office, and he said, well, there's a lot of need here, you know that. And we said, well, where would you suggest? And he took his arm and made a wide sweep and said, out there. Now, that was 28,000 square miles of rural area. And Southwest Georgia, it's like I said, it was less than 1% Catholic, and they didn't have priests, sisters. They were also in need of medical help. So we had said, well, we can't, by ourselves start something medical, and we need to have a physician. And that's when we invited Jane Gates. And she had wanted to work with the Native Americans, but couldn't find anybody that, might be community with her. So she came down and she said, well, I want a group that prays together. And, I want to be in a poor place. So we start doing our research. We did library research. There was no internet in those days. So, we got our hands on everything we could. And one of the going things at that time was a social analysis, where is the need? And then we got in the car and traipsed all over Georgia, South Georgia, visiting these small towns. And it was like being back in another century for a lot of them. One town we went to, here was a doctor's office, and behind the doctor's office was a hospital, and behind the hospital was a cemetery, and then there was the river.
Oh.
And that's kind of like the way things went. So we finally found this place called Lumpkin, and the mayor of the town, met with us and said, yeah, you know, we need a doctor. We need a medical doctor. Well, in the beginning, people were very wary. We were Northerners. Mm-hmm. We were white. We were Catholic. And on top of that, we were sisters. Mm-hmm. And in some of their words, they used to say, we don't want no damn Yankee do-gooders coming down here, raising ruckus, and then leaving us to hold the hurt.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
That always got me. And we said, we will come. What we wanted to do was to try to open a clinic, because, I mean, this is where the health need was. They didn't have a doctor in this town, that where everybody would be welcome. Still, there were some people who wanted to run us out of town, you know. And so we said, we have to be kind of like on our best behavior. You know, put on the white coat, the hat, Jane. We'd put on our uniforms and, you know, nurse's hat and everything to start out, because we wanted to say, we're trying to give you quality health care, not just the dregs, because that is what they had had. The little town in the past had gone through a whole number of doctors who came and went, were alcoholics, you know, were bad practitioners who, you know, had their license being maybe taken away. And there was one who in the clinic, they gave us as a space to open, you know, was right next to the police department. And a previous doctor used to sit in the aisle of this clinic and shoot bullets out the back door. So when we came, we got these nice colored flowers to put over all the bullet holes on the back door.
Oh, my goodness.
The other thing was that, you know, this was shortly after the 60s and all the racial tension that was there. And even though it was law to not be segregated, in the minds of the people, this was just not really a reality yet.
Yeah.
So we said we would have one waiting room, because previously there was a black waiting room and a white waiting room. This is only one, you know, and one set of services and rooms and everything else in the back. So in the beginning, we got the poor black people, and then we got the poor white people, and then some of the middle-income white people and black people. And the waiting room was always a little bit touchy, because some white people wouldn't sit inside of it. They'd wait outside to get called because there were black people sitting there. It was an eye-opener for me, coming from a big city and the North, mm-hmm. where, you know, I was raised to think, you know, we're all equal, you know, we love everybody. But in a lot of ways, it was just all, you know, words mostly than deeds. And in this small town, I learned about community in a different kind of way. Mm-hmm. Although there was these vestiges of segregation, there people cared for one another, you know. We had a person who lived down the block from us was what you call a South Georgia redneck. One time he knocked at her door and he saw a young black man laying in the middle of the street. He picked him up, brought him in his car, took him to the doctor. And that was something that I, you know, just the experiences changed my perception of, you know, how people related to one another out of this long history of segregation and who's who. The churches were the white Baptists and the black Baptists, you know, the white Methodists and the black Methodists. And that was the majority of the religious, the religion and the churches in the area. So, but they were all very friendly. They would say, come on, sister, we're having pack a pew night, you know. So you're all invited. Or we got invited to, you know, the church suppers, et cetera, in terms of becoming part of the community, which took us a few years, but it, you know, like, at the time, you don't say, well, I think we're established, but looking back, you can say, all right, you know, the acceptance came gradually, and also who we were and what we did in terms of our values was also a gradual journey. Mm-hmm. So, you want to know more?
Yeah, I remember the story of Catherine Volker and her illness, and I mean, this very funny story about, did she make her own casket?
I know we made it for her.
You made it for her.
Okay. Well, even before I get to that story, because Catherine was a Southerner, she, in a sense, gave us cultural orientation because she knew the South. She was from Georgia. She knew the food. She knew how to talk to the people. We all had to learn that. So the people loved her. She was outgoing and extrovert, gregarious, you know, good-looking, competent, you know, all the kinds of things you'd hold up. And I would say that, you know, people knew who Catherine was and who Dr. Gase was, but the rest of us, well, we were just, we were there. We were one of the sisters, or, you know, sometimes they'd call us all Dr. Gates. You know, she would talk to me and say Dr. Gates or Sister Catherine. So we were there, I can't remember how many years it was, when Catherine, and we had gone through, I have to back myself up, I don't know if you're recording this all, you can, that we had we'd become the Church of Lumpkin. Because there were no Catholic churches, there were no priests. If we went out to a mass, it was like 40 miles in just about any direction, and sometimes they didn't have a mass. So we turned one of our rooms into a chapel, and we had our own prayer services. And when we could have a priest, we would invite the one other Catholic in town. Was a young woman who had a small baby. She was pregnant, then she had a small baby, and an elderly 90-year-old woman in the next town. Those were the Catholics in the area. And we were the only sisters, except for a group of about seven in Albany, who taught school in this 29,000 square miles. So we kind of became the Church of Lumpkin. So to get back to Catherine, after we were there, and I can't remember how many years, but it was 81 or 82, something like that, Catherine at one point in the springtime was not feeling good. She said she had a catch in her side. So went to the doctor, and the doctor thought she needed a hysterectomy. Well, we had to take her up to Columbus, and she had the hysterectomy, and I was there when it was all over, and the doctor came in and said she had a diagnosis of stage 4 ovarian cancer with metastases, because she had a lot of ascites that, you know, the cells are floating in the fluid in the abdomen. So he said, had I even thought about this, he would have did the operation differently, because there was a lot of stuff to try to wash out these floating cells. So, you know, Catherine recovered from that, from the operation. And all of us were trying to cope with this diagnosis. What were we going to do? How were we going to go about doing it? And Catherine said, please, I'd like to die in Georgia. And so we had a meeting, and we said, can we do this? Accompany her, and said, yes, we can and we will. So, in the early days, when she recovered from the operation, she was still pretty good and, came back to work in the clinic. We walked to the clinic. It was a very nice 10-minute walk there and back, and good exercise. And so for the first 3-4 months, she was doing real well. And she was taking care of her things. She was sorting out her clothes and her goods and giving stuff away. And she came one day and said, Eunice, would you ask your father to make me a coffin? And I says, oh, yeah. So I ride home and say, dear Dad, please send one coffin. Love, Eunice. My dad did woodworking. So we said, well, how can we do this? Because Catherine was a bit of a tomboy. And she says, I don't want to be laid out in one of those things with all this fluffy stuff around me. I said, okay. So I started researching, what kinds of things were there out there. And again, this was not internet age. I had to do it by word of mouth and leather and all that kind of stuff. And found a place that you could buy just a pine box, or you could buy the pieces and put it together yourself, or you could buy the plans and start out getting your own wood. So we bought the pieces. And it came one day, and Pat Edelin said, oh my gosh, she was not for this at all. She thought it was, Jane and Rosla Liberty, who was another sister who was down there and our bookkeeper, they worked on putting it together and finishing the wood beautifully. Mm-hmm. They stained it and sanded it and coated it, whatever the coating was. And it became a way of dealing with the dyeing process that was going on in our midst. I made the very simple kind of padding for the bottom and a pillow, and one of the local women in the town said, can I do a candle wicking design? And I said, what's candle wicking? I said, yeah, Catherine would be okay with that, because it's low-key, yeah. It's not really frilly. So we went through the summer and the fall and we made this casket, and then they were making it out in kind of a barn, and we said, we can't leave it out there because it'll get all warped. So we brought it into the house, and it actually brought it upstairs to the room that I slept in and put blankets in it. And when the local townspeople said, we hear y'all are making a coffin, and we said, sure, you want to see it? You can even try it out if you want. So they traipsed upstairs. Oh, my. This was a phenomenon nobody had ever heard of, making your own coffin. But again, it was a way of dealing with our journey. So the coffins. Oh, and I had written to my father, then said, can you make us a cross? And write on it, I'm the resurrection and the life. It was a simple kind of, wide cross with the words on it. And he had sent that. Mm-hmm. So we were ready for this thing. This coffin took 24 screws to put the top on. So when we had a funeral down there and when we had the funeral up here in Philadelphia, all of us came with our screwdrivers, because when it was time to close the coffin, we pull out.
Oh, my goodness.
You had to do, it didn't have a hinge or anything else. You had to put the top on and put the screws in. So, that was a piece of the journey. But the year before Catherine died, her father had a stroke. And on Christmas Day, she got a call from her mother saying, we thought we were all okay, that we had an insurance policy and we would be taken care of in our old age. But they could not get him into a nursing home. There's some clause that with something that was terminal. So nobody would take him. And Catherine asked if we could bring him down to our place. So we rearranged rooms. These were simple rooms with, I always say we had visual privacy, but not sound privacy, because there was...
Thin walls.
We put some of these walls up ourselves just to make like... I mean, they weren't real walls. So we rearranged things, and she came down in the ambulance with her father, and he was in the only bedroom that was on the first floor. He was a complete bed patient, you know. From January till about April, we took care of her father. Every morning we'd wash him and change him and turn him and then go to the clinic and then come back and turn him again and feed him. And because I was telling you about the church, our being the Church of Lumpkin, when it came to Holy Week and Holy Thursday, I was in the kitchen cooking, and we were going to go out to Mass, these 40 miles. And Catherine said, "I don't think so. We can't do this. You know, I don't want to leave them." Well, Jane came home from the hospital and said, "Oh, it's going to storm out there. You know, we're not going anyplace." So I said, "Well, we do our own service here." We had been doing, you know, small services, but we said, "Holy Thursday, we'll do it ourselves." So turned the stove on low. I got the books out and the guitar and the songs and the candle and bread and wine. And we fixed a service in the context of a meal, because that's what Holy Thursday is about. So we're at the table and we're saying these prayers, and all of a sudden, Catherine said, "He's gone." And he was just like, there was a little bit of a hallway. We were in the dining room, and the bedroom was right there. So we all got up and went. Yeah, he had expired just then in the middle of the service. So she said, "My father would have wanted us to just give a toast." So we went back and got our glasses of wine, came into his bedroom. We prayed over him and, you know, and drank some wine. So this is the year before. So the next year, it's Christmas again. And it was on Christmas night, Pat and I, we were watching The Sound of Music for the, you know, 10th time or something like that. And Catherine started vomiting. Terrible, just terrible projectile vomiting. Jane was at the hospital, so I called her up and, you know, she says, "Get some Compazine, blah, blah, blah." Well, that was the beginning of her really going downhill from January. It's the same timeline. She was in the same room that her father was. So it was bit by bit, you know. When we tried to feed her, anything that went down came right back up. She was getting weaker and weaker. So we told people, we got her family down, we got her brother from Florida, her sister and her mother from Atlanta. Many medical mission sisters came, but you know, at that time, it's when somebody's going downhill, you just don't want to have a lot of visitors. You know, people from town would come and we say, "You can go and look and say a prayer, but don't, you know, don't bother her." So we said we wanted to stop just trying to feed her, and she says, "No, that'll mean I'm killing myself." And I says, no, not really, because anything that went down came back up, you know. And then she finally decided, yeah, okay. So she was getting weaker and weaker, and it's January, it's February, it's March, and we said, you know, maybe she's hanging on for the same time that her father died. Still, we couldn't get a priest to come out. You know, when we tried, nobody would come out. So we said, you know, in the Catholic Church, you say prayers of anointing. So, you know, we got some oil, got the prayers out again. And Catherine said, she was like this, "Okay, grease me up." Wow. So we did. And it was, you know, it was a physical journey with her, but also a very spiritual journey. And then she was having, when she was having real dark days, you know, we would play MT's music, sit with her, you know, try to pray with her, or just sit and hold her hand. So again, we're coming around to Holy Week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and here's Thursday's coming. So we say, okay, we got to do it ourselves again this year. So we had a Holy Thursday. We go into her room, and she says, I'm still here. You know, why can't I die? Okay, next Good Friday, I'm still here. And I said to Jane Gates, I said, something is holding Catherine back because she should be dead. You know, she's skin and bone. She hadn't eaten anything. You know, she really should have been dead a couple weeks ago. And, you know, when Holy Saturday comes, and I said, we got to do something. I think we need to get her mother back here. And so I said, all right, Jane and I said this. And I said, Jane, you're going to have to deal with her mother, because her mother was like Catherine, big extrovert, you know, everything was out here. And I said, something, you know, it's got to happen. And I says, I'll make sure Catherine is okay, you know, for this. So we call her sister up, and they're going to come. I forget which day of the week. They're going to come back down. So when they arrived, again, you know, her mother was all excited and stuff like that. And I says, we're going to go in and pray over Catherine, and then we're going to just leave the two of you alone. So we did that, left the two of them alone, and went out, and we were getting, you know, tea and cookies and stuff like that. And Anna Mary, who had was helping us out there for a time, I said, Anna Mary, stay. Catherine's mother and mother talked together, and it was just a couple minutes later, her mother came out and said, I forgave her for not giving me any grandchildren. And I says, oh my gosh, is this what it has all these years? So I told Anna Mary, I says, go in and sit with Catherine. A couple minutes later, in just a couple minutes, Anna Mary comes out and says, she said, it's beautiful. Oh, so beautiful. Those were her last words. She didn't die then, you know, she went into a coma. So, again, she was just there. We stopped the morphine because she was getting morphine and Dilaudid, you know, every 2 hours because the pain was so awful. All right, so next morning we wake up, she's still there and she's still breathing, you know, still in the coma. And the others go off to the clinic, and I'm there with Rose. And in the middle of the morning, you know, you know how you just sense something? And Rose was sensing it too. So I called the office and I said, Jane was somebody who always wanted to know the details. So I called her and I said, her blood pressure's the same, you know, her breathing's the same, her, you know, give the rundown of the system. I says, but I think you need to come. Mm-hmm. So they left the patients there and told her they had to go for Sister Catherine. So they all came, and we had just, Martina was there too at this time. We all stood around the bed, and it was again just like 3 to 5 minutes, not long at all, she breathed her last. And I said, she lived, you know, a life with big flair, and this is the way she died. To me, the experience of Catherine was an experience of vulnerability, of being, having my back up against the wall and like the floor falling away, because, you know, like we didn't know what to do to help her till we figured out this thing with her mother. And I said, you know, when you feel like that, that you're being upheld even when you can't hold yourself up. Wow. So when she died, in like 2 minutes or 5 minutes, word got around town. And the house was flooded with people. You know, they came, and we hadn't vacuumed in a long time because of the noise. They start cleaning. They brought food. They had been bringing the townspeople almost for those 3 months. food appeared on the table for supper, and not just, you know, casseroles. Some people would bring a casserole and a jug of tea and a cake and a So through all this time, you know, we were being fed. Our meals were just came in the door. You know, it was beautiful. So when she died, again, you know, the women of the town started to take over, mostly the white women. So we took her to get the body prepared and figure out, you know, you do all this. You call Fox Chase, you call her family, everything else. And call the funeral director, who had never done a Catholic funeral, so he spent a lot of time asking me how to do things. And we were going to ship her body up to Philadelphia because, you know, there was no place to bury her down there. And discovered that at that time, it was It didn't cost more than a first class ticket, you know, to get the body up there. So her body comes back to the house to get waked, and people start coming. You know, they start coming, and it's just in the house. She was in the room where the chapel was, and the white people came, and the black people start coming. And this one woman came up to me, and there's food, you know. Wakes are always food, prayer, you know, conversation. This white woman came up to me and said, so-and-so has come in, you know, do I have to give her a plate of food? I says, everybody who comes through the door gets to eat. And she was just like shaken. I think never in her whole life had she been confronted with dealing with a social situation like this, that she would have to serve a black person a plate of food. That just struck me and stuck with me. I says, everybody who comes through that door can eat. So then it's where to have a service. The white church was too small. The black church was too small. The Methodist, the Baptist. So one of the people suggested the old school gym, which, yeah, we were going to use that. So they got the inmates. There was a local prison. They got the inmates to come and clean it up, you know, the bleacher seats and everything else. And we send out the invitation to all the churches. And we got a priest this time, and we said, bring everything you need because we don't have it. So while, you know, all of this is going on, a good friend of ours drives up to the back door and says, sister, don't worry, I'll take care of the black armbands. And I go, what black armbands? He says, for the ushers, you know, you've got to have that. I go, okay, take care of the black armbands. We got one of the Methodist women, she was going to play a piano organ, you know, one of those keyboards. But she said, and we said, what kind of songs do you sing in the Methodist church? And she says, we don't sing. Oh. All right. So we found a song we can sing. It was Amazing Grace or something like that, you know. And I did a guitar with one of our songs. One of the black preachers got up to give testimony. I mean, he was really, and do I hear an amen? You know, it was an ecumenical. And I stood up at one point and looked around and I said, I think this is the reason that we came. I don't know that we made any impact on the health because, I mean, the 300-pound people were still 300 pounds and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it was the first time in that little town that the black and the white and the Methodist and the Baptist and now the Catholics, all these people were together in a social situation, you know, because they loved Sister Catherine. It was phenomenal. anyway, I said, you know, that's why we were there. You know, never mind all this nice stuff we put on a piece of paper. So then we flew Catherine up to Philadelphia. There's only one plane out of Columbus, Georgia. After the service in the auditorium, the priest stands up and says, and everybody is invited to the sister's house for some food.
Oh.
Now, the food we had, but I mean, the space wasn't big enough in our house, and it was raining outside, and I says, let them come. They'll can figure out what to do. There were 7 cakes left over.
Oh, my God.
So another woman got a bunch of hat boxes, and all we came up to Philadelphia. You know how they have a repast with 7 of these cakes and hat boxes?
Oh, my goodness.
For the funeral up here.
Wow. Beautiful.
So.
It's very touching.
There's a lot of stories, individual stories I could tell. I don't know what else you want to know or would like to talk about, or is this enough for?
Well, going back to, I wanted to know, Sister Jane was the only doctor in that area. So how, if people needed like surgery, and how did that go?
If they needed surgery or something more intensive, they had to go up to Columbus, that was 40 miles away, or Americus, there was a hospital there, because we couldn't do it in our place. Also, in Georgia at that time, if you were a granny midwife, you know, you could deliver babies. Catherine Volker was a certified nurse midwife, but could not do any deliveries because you had to have access to a blood supply within a certain number of miles, and we didn't have that. We were too far out. And she always felt bad about that, you know, because, you know, she could have been doing that. When we had patients, one patient came in, and he's holding his hand over his eye, and you can see the blood dripping down. They did a lot of logging there, and a knot from a tree hit him in the eye. You know, you take one look, and Jane goes, bandage it up. You know, we got to send him to Columbus. So, you know, if it was big things like that, we had to send him elsewhere. We could take care of the ordinary things. We had another woman come in. She was very nicely dressed, and there was, you know how doctor's offices are. You have a little window. She comes up to the window and says, can I see the doctor? Pat often worked the front desk, and Pat goes like, what's wrong? And she says, well, I burned myself. So she calls me, and I take the woman back. A lot of the houses were just heated with either wood stoves or fireplaces. It was cold, and she backed up to the fireplace and caught on fire. She was burned, like, from the knees all the way up her back and her front. You know, the skin was just hanging out. And, you know, Jane says, well, we got to send her up to Columbus, bandage her up. You know, and I was like, I don't, you know, how? I got all this gauze out and, you know, was trying, you know, to keep it clean and, you know, put something on her so that, you know, she could get in the ride up to Columbus. It was stuff like that, you know, in these rural areas, they just didn't have access to medical care. But she had, you know, she had taken her nightgown off and put on her good clothes because she was going to see the doctor.
So, having been in med school or starting med school and feeling that it didn't resonate with who you were, and then you were a Numpkin doing medical assistant or whatever, how was that for you?
Well, when we first went down to Georgia, we were in Savannah for 3 years, and Catherine was getting back into the American scene, and so was Pat in terms of pharmacy and working at the local hospital. And I, first the bishop said he wanted me to work for him, but then again it was woman, young, northerner. No. So I started volunteering at the local health department, and you know, I was doing clerical work, and then I was doing some of the clinics, and then, you know, I was running some of the, like, the WIC clinics and the immunization clinics, and, you know, because I knew all that stuff. So the head nurse there said, why don't you just go back to school and get an associate degree, because I had a bachelor's. I said, well, that's kind of going backwards. She says, but, you know, you won't have to take all the science courses. You'll just need the nursing courses, which was true. So I did. And I got an RN, you know. Again, I mean, college, when I got my BA, it was a challenge, you know, and I did well. In Georgia, the level of education was not quite that high. And for just graduating, they gave us a test, and I said, this is not even a nursing test. This is kind of like, general education. And about half the class flunked.
Oh, my.
Literacy test.
Wow.
I go, whoa. So.
It's relative, I guess.
Yes, right. The school was just delighted to have me.
Yeah.
Because I upped their status.
Yeah. Wow.
I always heard about, well, I heard some rumors about how Sister Jane was sort of strict.
She was.
How was that dealing with her in Lumpkin?
Community-wise or with the patients?
Community.
Well, the patients loved Dr. Gates. You know, they always called her Dr. Gates. They loved her. She was wonderful to them, you know. It was like she could walk on water. Lots of times, she was, you know, we wanted to wring her neck. See, she had been out of medicine for so many years, and a piece of it that, you know, we kind of learned through just going through it was, you know, she was dealing with her own anxiety and nervousness about, you know, just, she loved medicine, but because she had been out so long, you know, it was a big challenge for her, and so she would just get really uptight and strict and, you know,
yeah,
do this or do that or whatever, just, so, I mean, through the years, it took us several years, you know, we came to a different space when she got to be more comfortable and, you know, kind of like settled down inside of herself. But yeah, there were those moments when she just, you know, because that's also part of who she was, you know, she was the doctor.
Yeah.
You know,
the territory.
The doctor, she was also of German background. And she was also, you know, to her dying days, she was very fiscally tight. You know, her books, we had her book, like, you know, every penny was accounted for. And I go, oh, you know, you're not going to find that when I die. I mean, I do a general job of keeping it straight, but she was, you know, to the penny. So, you know, sometimes she'd get upset with us, you know, oh, that was too much money. You shouldn't have, you know, gotten that. I said, we're only buying toilet paper, Jane.
And she was also adjusting from being Superior General.
Yeah.
So from a role of intense responsibility to living in community again.
Yeah.
As a sister.
Yeah. She wanted community. That was important to her, and prayer together. And when we talked, we said, well, we don't want it, because in times past, people used to read the office, the divine office, as something religious did, and priests, you know, a lot of them still do, you know, that set prayers. And we said, no, we will do our own, you know, read some psalms, but also have, you know, some spontaneous stuff or sing some songs, you know, that would be our prayer together, just sitting quietly, maybe for 15, 20 minutes, whatever, we would just put it together. So, again, it was that changeover into a more contemporary style of praying together. And that meant a lot to her. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, she accepted to come. you know, and loved it, because even leaving Lumpkin, you know, she says, I love practicing medicine. I'll never be able to do this again. We had said when we came that, you know, we weren't going to start a clinic and, like, be responsible for it forever and ever. You know, we said maybe 7 years or so, because our aim is to get it built up and turn it over. Because small places like this had a hard time finding doctors because the school system was so not good. And young doctors out of school, didn't want to raise their kids in this atmosphere. Or their wives, they were mostly men, you know, the social in a little town, the social attitudes could be just, you know, not nice a lot of times, you know, because these people grew up and know one another and yak. So, but she knew some of the doctors in Columbus, and they would send down some of their physician's assistant and also young doctors to work with Jane, because she was an excellent diagnostician. Mm-hmm. Without having the use of all these sophisticated machines. She could go hemoglobin 6, you know.
Wow.
Because in Africa, she didn't have these things. And so by listening to the patient, you know, listening to their heart, their liver, or whatever else, the color of their skin, you know, and she was right, spot on, you know, spot on.
So when you left Lumpkin, did the clinic continue?
We had gotten a doctor. He was of Indian origin. He was nearby. He didn't want to live in Lumpkin, but would come up, like a lot of doctors now, they have an office here and an office here and an office here. And so he was there for quite some time. But another thing that happened when we were there is the government started a health center in the next town, which was like 9 to 10 miles away.
Okay.
So, you know, we would lose patients also to that. And I said, well, the area is covered, you know, so even if the one in Lumpkin itself doesn't continue, you know, they've got one there. Now in Lumpkin, they have an EMT service and, you know, who could get people to that clinic in Richland. And also, there was a young woman there who got out of the Army. Her family was Army, but her family grew up there. You know, she lived in her mother's house and was very inspired by Jane. And so she went on to nursing school and got her, nurse practitioner, and I don't know, a master's or something. I mean, you know, she really got trained and kind of like became the person working in Richland at that place. But, you know, it's like she became the next Dr. Gates.
Yeah.
So all of those pieces together said, you know, that will continue.
Yeah.
Church, but the healthcare will continue. And Suzanne, in these last years, her name was Suzanne, Jane and Suzanne would talk to one another almost every single night on the phone. For a long time, they didn't. And then at one time, you know, because Suzanne just needed somebody to also, somebody she could share stories or ask questions and stuff like that. But now the people down there really, you know, because she's very caring of the people, very competent, all of those kinds of things.
I remember when Jane passed in January that there was a Lumpkin response. Like, there were people in Lumpkin that were still feeling very connected to all of you.
Yeah.